From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, are we headed for mass extinction? And here's what's happening. In Ferguson, Missouri, state troopers are taking over security in the St. Louis suburb after days of clashes between local police and protesters. The governor there, Jay Nixon, said he decided to put the Missouri State Highway Patrol in charge of security because at this particular point, the attitudes just weren't improving. It was a great move on his part. Tonight, no violence. Lately, the community of Ferguson, which has been the scene of demonstrations and strong police response in the wake of a weekend police shooting that left an African-American teenager, Michael Brown, dead, has looked more like a war zone, according to the governor. Iraqi Prime Minister Maliki has stepped aside, called it quits, ending political deadlock in Baghdad as the government struggles against the insurgents there. He resigned on state television to make way for Haider al-Abadi, who was asked by the Iraqi president to form a new government. Mr. Maliki has been under intense pressure to make way for Mr. Abadi, a deputy speaker of parliament. An offensive led by the Islamic State rebels in the north has, of course, triggered a security and humanitarian crisis. Guinea has now declared a national health emergency as it battles to curb the spread of the deadly Ebola virus. This meant tighter border controls, the immediate isolation of anyone suspected to have Ebola, and a ban on moving bodies from one town to another. Ebola has killed more than 1,000 people in West Africa amid fears that it could spread elsewhere. You know, more than 1.6 million cardiovascular-related deaths per year can be attributed to sodium consumption above the World Health Organization's recommendation of 2,000 milligrams a day. And researchers have found in a new analysis evaluating populations across 187 countries that people tend to die more if they take too much salt. An expert on the heart, myheartbook.com, Christian Wild. Christian, why is salt dangerous to the heart in that kind of quantity?
Well, George, first of all, good evening. It's nice to talk to you. It's been a while.
Thank you, sir.
You know, somebody may not even have a clue their blood pressure is at a dangerous or life-threatening level unless they themselves or their doctor are monitoring it. They don't call this, pardon me, the silent killer for nothing. It might be a good safeguard for every family to have a monitor in their homes. If your blood pressure or your wife's or your child's, for that matter, is elevated, it's probably time to cut back on the salt. And if necessary, if your doctor advises, consider being on a blood pressure medication like an ACE inhibitor. This article, George, this study today, also concentrates just as much on cardiovascular disease because obviously the two go hand in hand. Elevated high blood pressure in heart disease, among other things, causes the vessels to stretch to the point of creating permanent fissures or stretch marks, I guess you could say, in which LDL cholesterol deposits can then lodge within the crevices, developing heart disease as we have come to know it. Elevated blood pressure can and does rupture aneurysms. It can upset the delicate electrolyte balance between magnesium and potassium and calcium and sodium, and particularly for those who exercise in very hot weather like what we are currently experiencing. Electrolytes can disrupt heart rhythms, cause fibrillation. So with the information warning us about the excessive salt in fast foods and prepared foods, this advice should be well taken. I think this is valuable information, and we should not take it with a grain of salt.
Literally. Track Christian's work, myheartbook.com. He's got a toll-free number for you, too. It's 1-866-STEM-123. Thank you, Christian. Appreciate it. Have you ever eaten those ramen noodles? Cheap dinners among college kids and budget eaters. Well, now they've been linked to heart attacks and diabetes. A study published in the Journal of Nutrition found that the ramen, along with other instant noodle products, may increase a person's risk for cardiometabolic syndrome, which is a risk factor for severe cardiovascular disease and stroke, and they say especially in women. Well, we find out tonight that Robin Williams was suffering from the early stages of Parkinson's disease at the time of his death, according to his wife. Susan Schneider said her husband had been sober, but not yet ready to share publicly his struggles with Parkinson's. She added that he had also been suffering from anxiety and depression. The 63-year-old actor was found dead in an apparent suicide in his home on Monday. Actress Arlene Martel, who played the prospective bride of Leonard Nimoy's Mr. Spock in the only episode of NBC's Star Trek set on the planet Vulcan, has died. She was 78. Martel died from complications of a heart attack at St. John's Hospital Center in Santa Monica, California. She was also on two episodes of The Twilight Zone.
Room for one more, honey.
That was one of the classics. She played the part of a nurse there. Arlene Martel dead at the age of 78. A Western Alaskan man has discovered a woolly mammoth tusk. What's so special about that? Well, 22 years after his mother found one in the same location. Joshua P. Warren, of course, is one of the top paranormal investigators on the planet, and he'll be with us for a couple hours tomorrow night on Coast to Coast AM. But he wants to tell you a little bit about why he's going to be on. What's up, Josh?
Well, you know, George, tomorrow is the big day. Tomorrow, August 15th, is the 37th anniversary of the WOW signal. And we are sending a personal message from you, George, into outer space all throughout the day. We're going to be providing a live free webcam of the skies over Puerto Rico near the GPS coordinates in your message, asking visitors to appear. But better yet, I've sort of expanded this project so that listeners around the world can participate in the process. So if you're a ham radio operator, if you experiment with radionics, or if you just want to telepathically help send the message from your mind into space, to hear George's message and find a transcript and also see the live web feed and all kinds of wild UFO pics from Puerto Rico, go to Arecibo Project.com for instructions. And we're asking all the listeners to help us, George. Visit the website tomorrow and help us monitor the live stream. Arecibo is spelled A-R-E-C-I-B-O. So that's AreciboProject.com. If that gets slammed, the backup site is AreciboProjectBackup.com. And we're going to be recording video all around the area, including with third-generation night vision when the sun goes down, so I can come back and give you a full report tomorrow night.
All right, Josh, we'll talk to you tomorrow night. Sounds good. Story at our highlights reel at CoastToCoastAM.com. Seven tiny grains of rock captured by NASA's comet-chasing Stardust probe back in 2004. Maybe visitors from the vast reaches of interstellar space. According to researchers, the interstellar dust motes from Stardust are fluffier and more diverse than expected, findings that could one day shed light on the origins of the solar system. You can go see that story at coasttocoastam.com. Talking about the solar system and what's going on in space, let's check in a moment with Robert Zimmerman, space historian. BehindTheBlack.com next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Robert Zimmerman with us for a couple hours, award-winning space historian. He's written articles and books on the issues of science, history, technology. Some of his works include Genesis, The Story of Apollo 8, The Universe in a Mirror, The Chronological Encyclopedia of Discoveries in Space. Without a question, Robert, you love space.
Yeah, I would say that's probably true. Actually, George, the real more precise thing is I love exploration. I love pushing the unknown. I'm interested in that. Space is at the peak of that. Exploring the solar system and beyond astronomy is pushing the ultimate unknown. But unknowns anywhere interest me. You know, as you know, I do cave exploration, and I've actually gone multiple times where no human had ever gone before in that exploration. So I'm interested in wherever it is, whether it's up in the sky or under the earth.
What's the most fascinating thing you've seen in a cave, Robert?
The most fascinating thing?
Because it's a different
interesting
world.
The whole experience of caving in itself is an alien experience. You know, we grow up, especially in this modern world, we are all used to having light available at all times. You know, even at night comes, we just turn a light on. And so we're just used to that. And being in a cave, it's dark. Even if you have a headlamp, it's dark. You really don't get good view of what's around you. The actual travel through a cave is very different than, you know, you don't walk. You almost never walk. And even when you are walking, it's very uneven ground. There's no trails, per se. Many times your hands and knees crawling. Sometimes you have to work your way through rocks. So it's a very different kind of experience in that sense. I have a very good sense of direction on the up above ground. I can pretty much always know where I am relative to everything else around me. In underground, it's three-dimensional and it's complicated and it's not so simple. So there's a bigger challenge finding your way around. So it's just the whole experience is different. If there's a stream passage with water flowing, you hear the sound and it's an underground sound, so it's not like a babbling brook on the surface. It's just a different experience overall, and that I think is what makes it interesting and unusual. Specific things in a cave, I have a joke saying that when you've seen one cave, you've seen one cave. They're all different.
Is it like a different world?
Yeah, it's a different world. It's very different. The formations are different. People who've gone to commercial caves, tourist caves, they've seen some of that because usually those caves have the most unusual formations in the world. But I've been in some caves that are not commercial that have some strange formations that that are almost inexplicable in terms of how they form. They are not natural. They are natural, I should say, but they are an example of why I think the universe is a wonderful place, because the universe can produce things that are inexplicable and we don't understand. That's why I like space and astronomy. It's a wonderful place. You get all these weird things.
Sure is. Robert, we have started a campaign with worldnetdaily.com, WND.com, and that is to try to protect and insulate our power grid from an X flare from the sun.
Okay.
And we're trying and we're working with some possible legislators to get some action here. It's estimated it'll cost $1 to $4 billion to insulate, but well worth it, because without electricity, we are up the creek. And, you know, you've looked a little bit at solar flares, and it's, you know, to me, it's not a matter of if, but when it happens. What do you think's going on with the sun these days?
In this case, George, we are in very much disagreement. I am not concerned in the slightest about a solar flare doing us any harm. And my experience within the science space weather community is that most of the lobbying that's going on today is purely that. It's lobbying for funds. The real question that the sun is posing to us today, and that is a significant scientific mystery, is why is the sun not producing sunspots in great numbers?
Well, I'm not talking about just today, though. I mean,
I'm talking about over the last decade.
Yeah, exactly.
This is overall. When the sun's solar maximum about 10 years ago started to end, solar scientists were split. They were trying to predict what the next solar maximum would be like. Mm-hmm. And half the community thought it was going to be a very dangerous, active, violent solar maximum, where your concerns about giant solar flares and our electric grid might have carried weight. The other half of the community said, no, it's going to be a weak solar maximum. The split between the community, by the way, indicated how little they really understand the solar dynamo and what produces sunspots. They really don't know. They were just kind of making a guess, and they've split between them. Well, the community that thought it was going to be a weak solar maximum this time was right. But they themselves overestimated how weak the solar maximum would be. The minimum itself was about twice as long as expected. It went on and on and on. No sunspots for not just 1 year, not just 2 years, not just 3 years, for almost 5 years, there were practically no sunspots. And then when it started to produce sunspots again, the sun, as it started its slow process to flip its magnetic polarity, they were far fewer than they normally see. And that continues to this day. It's been one of the weakest solar maximums. It's the weakest solar maximum in 100 years.
Why?
Well, that they don't know. I wrote my first article about the sun and the solar maximum was back in the mid 90s, and at that time my article was, will the activity of the solar of the sun put us in a destroy the electrical grid?
Right.
Right. Well, my next article, major article I wrote for Sky and Telescope about now 6 years ago, was what's wrong with the sun? And in doing, and why is it not producing sunspots? And I actually asked one of the top solar scientists in the world. He works at Goddard Space Flight Center. Do you guys understand what's going on? And he said bluntly, no. They know this is related to the dynamo of the sun and its magnetic field. They know it's related specifically to the flipping of that magnetic field's polarity every 11 years. It does that. But the actual detailed process, they don't know yet. They don't really understand it completely. They do know that the sun periodically, every few thousand years, and they don't even know exactly how often or why, but the sun will go through something called a grand minimum. We know of one that was in documented history back in the 1600s. That's what, right after Galileo saw the first sunspots with a telescope, sunspots disappeared for almost a century, 70-some-odd years.
Strange.
And they call that the Maunder minimum, named after the guy who first documented it. They didn't know there was a solar cycle for the first 100 years of telescopes because there were no sunspots visible. And then the sunspots started to reappear, and they started to map the solar cycle. Other scientists have now gone back in time using proxies of the kind of evidence, and that evidence indicates that there have been grand minimums in the past. Every time there's been a grand minimum in the past, George, every single time there is the Earth's climate cools. There was a little ice age in the 1600s with the previous grand minimum. Now, how does that affect the Earth? Well, we don't really know how the sun's lack of sunspots links with cooler temperatures. There's a circumstantial connection, but scientists yet don't have a connection, don't really understand how the two can be linked. They have theories. But nonetheless, that's the case. Now, we've seen a drop in sunspots for the last half decade or more. And lo and behold, we've seen what the global warming activists in the climate community call the pause, where suddenly the climate has stopped warming completely now for almost 20 years, 18 years. So are they linked? We don't know. I mean, I can talk to you at greater length after the break about what we think might be some of the links, but the actual knowledge, certainty, it doesn't exist at this moment.
Robert, could it change at any time?
I mean, we don't know. We're not even sure if this weak solar maximum could be a precursor to another grand minimum where we don't see sunspots for 70 years.
Yeah.
It could be, you know, not. We could see a recovery of sunspots in the next solar maximum, but we just don't know. We don't understand the process yet. It's part of the whole. It's really part of the whole climate field. This is a very. Baby field. It's only just been born in the last 2-3 decades. We don't really know a lot.
Now, two years ago, we dodged a huge X-flare bullet. Mm-hmm. What happened there?
Well, all right. Look, the sun can produce X-flares, but that story I was one of the most hyped stories I've ever seen in my life. I saw that story that came out about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, about how in 2012 we almost were fried by a flare, and that wasn't the case. The sun to produce a really, really, really powerful flare that might damage the grid, we haven't seen anything even close to that in a long time.
Since the Carrington event. Right?
Yeah, the Carrington event. And we haven't seen anything even close to that in a long time. And I should say that The last time there was a serious problem was back in the late 80s during a solar maximum. That's two maximums ago. And in that case, we had a blackout in Quebec. And I think the grid has dealt with that issue now very effectively.
We're going to be back with more with Robert Zimmerman on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Robert Zimmerman with us. We'll take calls with Bob Zimmerman next hour. Robert, you know, during the 1969 time period when we landed on the moon, there was incredible excitement about our space program. It started to die down. Where is it today? Is that excitement still around?
The American public has always been passionately interested in the exploration of space, and that continues. Where the American public has had ambivalent feelings from even in the 60s is whether or not their tax dollars should be used to do such a thing. In the 60s, we were in a Cold War, and then the death of John Kennedy, who had made the commitment to go to the moon, kind of created an emotional lockstep, commitment by the nation to complete that dream. We wanted to beat the Russians. We were in that race, but we also wanted to achieve what Kennedy had proposed in honor of his memory. I think that was a very strong emotional foundation for the 60s space race. But once that was accomplished, there's been strong ambivalence in the American public for decades about whether we should spend money in space. Now, I've always been a big advocate of going to space, but and I have to admit that for many, many years I was blindly, let's have a big space program, let's have a big space program. And in watching this unfold for the last 4 or 5 decades, I really came to the realization about a decade ago, a little more than that, 2 decades ago in the late 90s, that a big space program by the federal government is never going to accomplish anything. And it hasn't. It hasn't really gotten us anywhere. And I really wish it would go away completely. I don't want a space program. I've said it before on your show.
What about a military space program?
Well, I don't want a program. What I want is what we have in America, the concept in America, which is many people following their own individual dreams chaotically, and out of that grows a robust industry and achievement, and many possibilities occur. I mean, that's how the West was settled. It wasn't a government program to send settlers along the Oregon Trail. It was just ordinary Americans deciding they wanted to move and settle the West, and they went, and they did it. And I think that's how the space is going to be settled and how we are going to achieve it. And in fact, what's really invigorating to me now, and I've talked about this on your show before, George, is that's exactly what's beginning to happen right now. The federal government isn't accomplishing very much, but what it is doing is it's decided to step back. NASA has decided to step back and act merely as a customer. It's buying its products from private companies who themselves are trying to make it possible to get into space. That's what's exciting.
Of the private companies out there, the Burt Rutans, the Richard Bransons, the Elon Musk's company, who's ahead?
Elon Musk's company is by far ahead of everybody, SpaceX. But they are not alone, and they are not going to be alone, and that's what's really thrilling about this, and that means we've got competition. They're not only competing with every other rocket launch company in the world and really driving them all insane because they can't compete with them, but they also have new other competitive companies that are looking around the fringes, but achieving credible successes step by step. And they're all coming out of the woodwork at the same time to a certain extent. Elon Musk's company, for example, I have this posted on Behind the Black today. I posted this today on Behind the Black. They just released new video of their Falcon 9 launch in July, in which they tried to bring the first stage back for what they call the soft splashdown over the ocean. What they're trying to do is get it so that that first stage can use its rocket engines to vertically land safely, and therefore they don't waste the first stage. They can then reuse it on a later launch. If they could do that, they cut the cost of launch in half. And this video footage shows this rocket coming down to the ocean under complete control with its engines firing. It's right out of science fiction, George. It's right out of the 50s, you know, rockets bringing something down. And it works. It lands over the ocean because they're doing early tests. They don't want to take a chance over land yet. They've demonstrated that they really have developed the technology to do this. Now, if they do this, they cut the cost and launch in half. So what you have now is one of their main competitors, a company called the United Launch Alliance. This is the company. It's a combination of Boeing and Lockheed. They just fired their CEO. He stepped down, but he's been their only CEO since the company was put together 6 years ago. He's been very successful as a leader of that company, but he hasn't been able to handle this competition. You have Ariane Space. They spent almost 2 years developing their next rocket that's going to replace the Ariane 5 commercial rocket. They dumped those plans because it was going to be too expensive and it wouldn't compete with SpaceX. You have the Russians completely restructuring their space program right now, because their rockets are too expensive and not very effective and they can't compete with SpaceX for the commercial market. He's shaking up the whole industry, and that's great. You've got other companies being in the background that are coming along, including Sierra Nevada with its Dream Tracer manned craft. You've got Jeff Bezos of Amazon.com. He's got his own private little company that he's developing a launch system, and he wants to make launch reusable and cheap, and he's going to show up out of the woodwork. All of a sudden, he's very quiet, very secretive, of a sudden, boom, he's going to be a competitor without question.
Are these guys doing it with their own money, Robert?
Yes, almost exclusively. Not entirely, but Elon Musk, he started out using his own money, and then he pulled in venture capitalists. It's not a corporation you can buy stock in still, SpaceX, and they say that's not going to be the case for a while because being privately held gives them the freedom to make risky decisions. Jeff Bezos from Amazon, it's all his own money for his New Shepard rocket. Other companies, Sierra Nevada is not a private company, but they have the resources to develop very new technologies. And Virgin Galactic, that's a case where Richard Branson, some of his own money, his corporate money, then he's pulled in investors from the Middle East, from Dubai, and so therefore that gives them the freedom to be, freedom. I love the word freedom to be creative and innovative and take risks. And the result is that we're seeing a whole industry develop. I always find this interesting, George. Every other country in the world has their national program, space program. Once we've unleashed, taken it out of control of NASA, only the United States can have multiple companies doing the exact same thing. And that's because we allow freedom to function here.
When we do go to Mars,
yes,
with man, is it going to be private?
Well, it's too far in the future at the moment to say. I personally think yes, because I think that the private industry can do it so much faster, especially when it's competitive and it's for profit. They can do it so much faster and they can innovate so much more quickly. So I think, yes, private will be the way to go. It's going to be a while yet before we're going to Mars. Elon Musk himself says he wants to die on Mars. Everything he's doing is with this in mind. He's going to be building his Falcon Heavy rocket. That'll be the most powerful rocket launched since the Saturn V. And he's doing it because it'll lower the cost to launch once again. And once that launches and its first stages will be reusable, you will be able to put 50-plus tons in orbit for the cost of what they now put at most, maybe 10 tons into orbit. So then you can start big payloads. You could start putting Saturn V Apollo-type equipment in orbit to go anywhere in the solar system. And Elon Musk is not doing it so that the government will have this access. He's doing it so that private individuals and private companies can buy the service and do it themselves, including himself. So yes, I think it's going to be private. I think there's no doubt in my mind. That's a prediction. I can't tell you if it's going to be different.
We've had a relationship with the Russians where they launch us, they bring us back, they launch us and bring us back ever since we stopped with the shuttle.
Yeah.
The situation with Russia in Ukraine is threatening that relationship.
Yes.
What happens when the Russians definitely just simply say, we're not taking Americans anymore?
Well, we're in trouble then, aren't we? ISS, our space station, which we paid for, almost all of the money to build that space station came out of American taxpayers' wallets, even if parts of it were built by others. We will not have access to our space station until American companies like SpaceX with its Dragon capsule, or Sierra Nevada with its Dream Chaser mini shuttle, or Boeing with its CST-100 capsule, until those companies come along with our capsules, and I expect that to happen sometime in the next 2 years, maybe even less. But until they come along, we're at the mercy of the Russians. Now, I'll tell you this, George. The Russians really, really do not want to break up that partnership, at least not now, not this moment.
No.
They get benefits from it themselves. They're not ready to break off. But there's no doubt in my mind, reading the Russian situation, that they are aiming for breaking up the partnership by 2020, that they want to have their own independent space program separate from us once again, and they're working towards that goal. And so they're looking sometime in the next decade to break free from this partnership. And so we better be prepared that come 2020, they've said they're not going to extend their agreement with us on ISS past 2020. We would like it extended. They've said no. They might change their minds, but I don't think they will. I think they're really interested in pulling free from us. And that might mean pulling their own modules free from ISS and putting their own space station independent of us into orbit. And so we have to start thinking about that, because and I don't particularly like the partnership. I mean, I don't mind us being at peace and working together, but I prefer competition. And I think if the Russians and the United States were competing with each other, we'd both get a lot more done.
What are the Chinese doing with their space program?
They're running independent of everybody else. They're using it kind of like the Russians did in the 60s as a prestige tool to make the world think of them as wonderful. And they're also using it for industrial development and also military development. But they are definitely competing with everybody else. They do not want a partnership. They want their own independent program. They are building their own space stations. They are working towards having a functioning space station in orbit that they can keep astronauts in for long periods of time. And they are doing it with the right idea. They are building these space stations as prototype interplanetary spaceships, figuring out how to build such a thing. Because if you keep people alive in space for a year or more in a vessel, then that vessel could take them to Mars. And that's their approach, and that's what they're doing. And they're independent of everybody else. They'd like to have some cooperation, but not in any way that's going to affect their own program. They'll work together with others when it's beneficial, but they want to keep their program independent of everybody else so they can accomplish what they want to accomplish.
I suspect that the Chinese would love to be able to develop a program where they can knock out satellites and everything else.
Oh, they have this program right now. They did an anti-sat test just a few weeks ago, in fact. And this was done very carefully so that it would not cause gigantic amounts of space junk, because they did another test like that a few years ago against the advice of their own engineers as well as everybody else who knew they might do it. But the management, the bureaucracy, and the leaders of China said, we're going to do this anti-sat test. They did it. They put tons of junk in orbits that are really bad. And so that was bad public relations for them. So they just did an anti-satellite test. Their program is definitely like the Soviet Union's was, and like Russia's to a certain extent today is. It's very mixed. It's military and civilian together. And so when they do a civilian mission, it has public relations, civilian research, you know, science for the world. But at the same time, they're developing technology which their military can take advantage of.
When I think of the movie Gravity, I think of this Chinese junk that destroyed that space station.
Yeah, that's actually quite legitimate. Yeah, exactly right. The junk from their anti-satellite test from a few years ago put tons of debris in orbits that ISS and other satellites use, and it's been a headache for everybody, including the Chinese, by the way, since that anti-satellite test. It did them a lot of bad public relations, so they know better now. But we got to deal with the problem until a few years, until most of that debris, you know, its orbits decays and gets out of the atmosphere.
Well, if the debris hits something, satellite up there, I mean, will it go right through it? Will it destroy it, or is it just a little tiny tap?
Well, it depends. I'll give you an example. They have on ISS for many years now, the Russians found this out on Mir as well. You get micro hits all the time. The Russians did actual survey spacewalks where they would actually survey the surface of Mir to see what kind of damage it had sustained over its 15-year life. They did this several times during its existence. And they found that over a period of time, you get a lot of micro hits. Those don't necessarily cause any significant problem. Depends on how fast the object's coming in and how big. There's no question that the right object at the right size, at the right speed, can do significant damage. And this is a concern that everyone in the space field has. It's one of the reasons why they periodically will move ISS to a slightly different orbit when they know an object might be coming by within a certain range and they want to keep it safe.
Are they tracking all space debris?
The U.S. Military, the Air Force, has a very sophisticated equipment and can track everything down to just a few inches, even less in size.
Amazing.
They know every object that's up there. And everybody uses that information in some manner or another. It's an interesting thing. It's even though it's done by the U.S. military for military purposes, the information is public enough that everyone, the Russians, the Chinese, everyone uses that information so that their vehicles do not get damaged.
Bob, could we build and launch a space vacuum that literally goes and sucks all that stuff up?
Private enterprise. There have been actually some private companies that have proposed doing exactly that, and they've offered it to countries. And, you know, this is actually a case where, once again, the nations become the customer. They have a need. They have ISS up there. They have satellites. Communications companies have a concern, though less so, because they're a geosynchronous orbit and there's less debris up there. But nonetheless, there is a need here for such a thing. And, yes, private companies have made
Amazing.
A proposal, and we can do it, yes.
Now, all the debris eventually will fall, right?
Not all of it.
No.
I mean, some of it, well, you know, it's a little more complicated than that. Some of it will fall quickly. Some of it will take maybe thousands of years to fall. The very first American satellite, Vanguard, that was launched in January of 58.
After Sputnik,
yes,
right?
That satellite was put in an orbit that's going to keep it up in space for a few thousand years.
It's still there?
Yes. And it's not going to go away because it was put in an orbit that's kind of high enough and it's small enough that it doesn't decay very
quickly. Why don't they go grab it? That's a relic.
Well, that's sure. There you go. Private enterprise. You know, a museum wants to put it in. Sure. Why
sure.
Not? But the point I'm getting at is that some debris will come down relatively fast. Some will stay up for a longer period of time. The ones that are up for a longer period of time are generally in orbits that are less of a concern. But nonetheless, it's always an issue. And yes, at some point down the road, this is going to be a business for somebody to make money cleaning up the junk in space.
Is there anything in space that scares you, Bob, or bothers you that is happening?
In what way, George?
Well, military, something dangerous to all of us?
No, I'm not. You know, one of the big concerns in the early 60s was that space could be used as a significant weapon against us. The kind of stuff that goes on in space, mostly by militaries, is surveillance. And some of that I don't particularly like because some of it's poking into our private lives more than they should. But I'm not particularly worried about a violent threat from space. No, I am not.
Well, that's a good thing. Bob, for folks who want to track you on your website?
Yes, behindtheblack.com. I post every day multiple times. I post about a lot of things, George, mostly about science and space, but I do talk about things that I think are of certain importance for me as an American and for other Americans, issues of the day.
And there are many.
Oh, there are many. And I think that people need to be informed about what's going on in the world today. My focus is always space and science and where it you know, how that's developing. That's the cool stuff. But I talk about other things as well.
All right, we're going to come back. Final hour to go with you, Bob Zimmerman. We're going to take phone calls about all things space. So get ready to let your fingers do the walking right here on Coast to Coast AM. We shall be right back.